And that's Glenn Campbell, Sing, Sing, Sing. And sadly, Glenn is in the final stages of Alzheimer's disease. And his voice and guitar have been silenced. You can check out my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show, Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern out of Toronto on Zoomer Radio. And for more information, just visit my website, strangeplanet.ca. And click on the radio page. There's also a list of affiliates, so you can find a station that airs the program near you. And you can also listen to the program live, or you can listen to past shows by downloading my free app, The Conspiracy Show, and that's available for both Androids and iPhones. Peter Janney is with us, and we'll continue to discuss his deeply personal voyage and investigation into the murder of JFK mistress Mary Pinchot Meyer. For those who study conspiracy, many political assassinations require the use of a patsy. Now, Fletcher Prouty, Chief of Special Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff under President John F. Kennedy, was in New Zealand in an airport when he read the headline, "Kennedy Shot," in the Christchurch Star newspaper. Oswald was named as the shooter. The story contained Oswald's detailed biography, his picture, his Russian past. The only problem was that the time Prouty was reading about Oswald in New Zealand, Oswald was still sitting in a movie theater in Dallas, yet to be arrested or charged. Now, Mary Pinchot Meyer's murder also involved a patsy, an African-American by the name of Raymond Crump. The murder of Mary Pinchot Meyer has a number of similarities with the mysterious death of Marilyn Monroe. One in particular jumps out. Both of these women kept diaries. And both of these diaries suddenly disappeared after they died. When we come back, I'll ask Peter Janney about that, and we'll also open up the phone lines and take your questions and comments as we continue to drill down into the murder of Mary Pinchot Meyer. We'll open up the phone lines at the bottom of the hour. Anyway, Peter Janney awaits. More on the other side. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Peter Janney, Mary's Mosaic, the third edition. Peter, walk us through the timeline of Mary's murder in October of 1964.
Well, all through 1964, amidst her grief, Mary was doing her own research as to what had really taken place in Dallas in November of 63. One of the people that she talked to was, you know, JFK's closest assistant, Kenny O'Donnell, and what's clear is that Kenny essentially told Mary the same thing that he told Tip O'Neill, which Tip wrote in his biography, which is the motorcade was driving into an ambush. The shots that killed Kennedy came from the grassy knoll, not from the Texas School Book repository behind him. They came from the front. And of course, were this to be corroborated, the Warren Commission's theory would have been flushed down the toilet. The way the shots took place in Dallas clearly showed that there was a conspiracy underway. And so Mary was working in 64, you know, writing notes in her diary, just spending a lot of time alone trying to deal with her own grief. She still maintained her daily routine, which was to go to her studio in the morning and paint for several hours, and then take a long walk about noontime. And she would walk down into Georgetown and walk out what's called the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal towpath out to a place called Fletcher's Boathouse, turn around and walk back. So when she was put under surveillance by Jim Angleton, in 1963, they knew what her routine was. And when the order came down that she had to go, that she had to be eliminated, a plan was concocted to make it look like a random act of violence, nonsensical murder in broad daylight on the towpath. And so on Monday, October 12th, the CIA team was out there, I think, very early, camouflage. They were radio controlled. They were setting things up. And they still hadn't decided, from my point of view, how the plan was going to unfold. but a patsy came along in Ray Crump Jr., who was going out the canal with his girlfriend to have a little tryst on the shore of the Potomac River. And I think that's when they decided, okay, we're going to go with this guy. This is our patsy. Let's get him, you know, let's get him watched, you know, let's get his clothes duplicated. And of course, they had all these kinds of ability to pull off operations like this. So this was, you know, the way that the murder unfolded. There was a stalled national Rambler on Canal Road, just above the place where Mary would be assassinated. And when the tow truck driver came to try and fix the car, as he was ordered to do, within 1 minute after his arrival, and he was late because Mary was moving away at that point out of the kill zone, but within 1 minute after this tow truck driver, Henry Wiggins, appears with his tow truck, the first shot rings out.
And witnesses reported that Mary, before she was murdered, she cried out, "Someone please help me."
Well, that took place as she was being murdered. You know, she wrestled with the assailant. Mary was in great shape, you know, for a woman her age. I mean, she was lean, she was well proportioned, you know, she exercised. And I think the assassin was a little bit taken aback as to how aggressive she was when he attacked her from behind. And that's when the screaming took place before the first shot was fired, which was a gun was put to the side of her left temple and the bullet traversed the brain going from left to right. She still tried to struggle after the first shot. She was bleeding profusely. She was trying to get over the embankment, but then the assailant grabbed her and dragged her back to the canal, right at water's edge of the canal, and positioned his gun just slightly under the right shoulder blade and angled slightly to the left and fired the second shot, which immediately severed her aorta, creating instant death.
A pretty messy operation. I mean, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but this is not a typical CIA hit, is it? I mean, why was it not done at a distance?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And, you know, this tow truck driver was not there by accident. This abandoned car was a setup because they wanted to have a witness. They figured that if the tow truck driver was there when the assassination went down, he might run across the street and look over the wall and say, you know, what's going on here? And of course, when he in fact did that, there was a guy who looked like Ray Crump in the sense that he was wearing the same clothes, same color of clothes, standing over the body right after she had been killed. And this was to create the appearance that, you know, this black guy had done the deed, when in fact the entire operation was a setup.
So Crump was later acquitted.
He was later acquitted in July of 1965 by the legendary African-American woman attorney, Dovie Rowntree, who really has saved this story. Were it not for Dovie Rowntree, there would be no Mary Meyer story. The fact that she could prove in court and create enough doubt on the part of the jury that Crump was being railroaded in this case led the jury to conclude there just isn't evidence here that supports this guy shooting this woman. And so Crump was acquitted at the end of his trial. It was this case made Dovie Rowntree's legal career. I mean, her reputation immediately went into the stratosphere, and she became extremely well known.
The person who receives a phone call and that it later identifies Mary in the morgue is, well, he was the future editor of the Washington Post. Then at the time, I believe he was at Newsweek, and that was Ben Bradley. Why was Ben the one to identify Mary's body?
Well, Ben was married to Mary's sister-in-law, Tony. And so you have to remember, in an operation like this, the CIA attempts to control every conceivable variable. And this call to Bradley that was made by my father came at a time slightly after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I confirmed this with Ben Bradley myself because I interviewed him twice for this book. And so he got this call from my father and basically said, Ben, you know, I just heard on the radio that there's been a woman shot down on the canal, and by the sound of it, it could be Mary. Do you know where Mary is? And of course, Ben said, you know, Wister, I'm not listening to the radio. I didn't hear anything like this. But, you know, Ben gets very alarmed and, you know, starts to pull himself together and leaves work. And then later that afternoon, the police show up at his door and basically say, Mr. Bradley, we believe we may have your sister-in-law in the morgue. Would you please come identify this body? And of course, the CIA, the public, the police did not know the identity of Mary Meyer officially until Bradley identified the body early that evening.
We should point out your father, Wister Janney, also a CIA official.
Correct.
When you made that connection, or after hearing it from Ben Bradley, that it was your father who called him, very strange phone call. No way would your father have known that the person who was shot was Mary Pinchot Meyer.
Right. Unless, of course, he was part of the operation.
It must have been a very painful revelation for you. Can you tell me what was going through your mind when you heard these words?
Well, Ben Bradley writes about this in his memoir in 1995. I mean, he identifies my father calling him. Of course, what he doesn't mention when he talks about it is that my father works for the CIA. He conveniently leaves out that little phrase. But when I finally got around to understanding and putting two and two together, so to speak, and this was probably, I think, the most defining moment of this happened in February of 2007, it was ghastly. I actually came to a fork in the road where I just was so upset and just said, I'm not sure I can do this. I can go through with this. I just don't know what to do. And it took me at least 2 months to be able to come back and resume my work. You know, being a mental health professional, being a clinical psychologist, the thing that I did at that point is that I went and found a therapist, and I said, look, I need help. I need someone to talk to. I'm really dealing something with terribly traumatic, and I don't want to give up, but I may have to. And so this woman that I met came highly recommended. She understood what was going on, and she was extremely helpful. And in about two and a half months, I was able to, you know, go back to work and say, okay, I'm dealing with it. It's a terrible thing to realize, but this story is so important for the public at large, because if people don't have the truth, Richard, they don't have anything. And that means whether it's an individual or a country, we are destined to make the same mistakes over and over again until we are willing to see the truth, confront the truth, even though it's making us miserable. We have to at some level start to embrace it so that we can really emerge and do something different, so that we don't keep spinning our wheels in sand and keep doing the same stupid things over and over again.
Your father, Wister Janney, had long since passed by the time you found this out.
Oh, yeah, he died in 1979. He didn't even reach 60.
What was your relationship? I can imagine you're a child of the 60s. Your father is, you know, another one of these Cold War warriors with the CIA, part of the Washington establishment. You're a young student, perhaps. What was your relationship like?
Well, that is a very good question, and I can certainly say the following. When I went to college in the fall of 1966, I was, you know, just a young pup wanting to, you know, learn and figure things out and become educated, whatever the hell that meant. So I went to Princeton, and the Vietnam War was starting to really get amplified. And I decided that I was going to figure this out and understand what the hell was happening. And it was at that point, you know, where I really had to question, you know, what is the CIA really doing? And what the hell is my father doing there in the world? You know, most of us CIA brats, we thought our fathers were James Bond or you know, something very similar to that, because that's what we had grown up with, and that's what the culture was. You know, the James Bond movies in the 1960s were really becoming very, very famous. And so I don't think any of us who had fathers working at the agency really began to understand what was actually taking place. I think this is true of St. John Hunt, who was Howard Hunt's son. I mean, he's...
Yes, I've spoken to St. John, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he had a similar kind of experience of having to awaken as to what was really taking place here. So this was, you know, a very turbulent time in our culture, the late 1960s. It was also a wonderful time to, you know, become educated in the best sense of what that word means, you know, in terms of really beginning to understand what our country is doing in the world, and of course confronting the horror of the Vietnam War and all that it represented, of which my father was, you know, one of the architects, I would say, having known now a lot since his death more about what he was doing.
Well, it's one thing, I guess, for you and your father to be sort of worlds apart in terms of your political views, but then to later learn that a woman who was, I guess, I don't know if I'm overreaching here, but to, you know, almost a second mother to you,
yes,
that he would have been involved in her murder.
Yes.
I just cannot imagine the emotional pain and trauma that must have caused you, and then to take it the next step and to put it all in this book, Mary's Mosaic, as I say, the third edition now available to readers. Where can people get a hold of the book, Peter?
The book is readily available on Amazon, and you know, any bookstore can order it, but it can be very quickly sent to anyone from Amazon. Amazon being one of the biggest distributors probably in the world right now.
Sure.
Just going back for a moment, Richard, in terms of your last comment, yes, this really fomented a separation between me and my father that just grew all through college. Our relationship, I think, was probably destroyed in the late 1960s. I mean, you know, we were thrown out of a restaurant, a very posh restaurant in Massachusetts, for starting an argument at the table, of which the entire restaurant started to take sides. And things got so out of control that the head waiter came over and just asked us to leave. But it was, I mean, there were a number of incidents like this. And of course, in this third edition, there's an appendix number 5. You will see a CIA memo that was chaired by my father, where it's very clear that the CIA, in this case, was admitting at this meeting that they were part of the JFK assassination.
Peter, I've got to jump in here. We'll pick this up on the other side. Peter Janney, Mary's Mosaic. Here's a song that may indeed have come from the Akashic Field, Tangled Up in Blue by the great bard of Hibbing, Minnesota, Bob Dylan, taking us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. And this is the very talented soprano, Patricia May Andrzejewski, better known by her stage name, Pat Benatar. The one and only George Norrie returns to the air chair tonight in the first half of Coast to Coast AM. He's joined by former banker John Truman Wolf, the editor-publisher of the Hard Truth magazine, and he'll discuss the state of U.S. and world economies and his analysis of what could be looming in 2017. In the second half, George welcomes Andrew Collins, who's been investigating the idea of advanced civilizations in prehistory since 1979, and Andrew is the co-discoverer of a massive cave complex beneath the Giza Plateau, now known as Collins Caves. That's all coming up tonight on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. And coming up in mere moments, your questions and comments for author Peter Janney. Mary's Mosaic, the CIA conspiracy to murder JFK, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and their vision for world peace. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Peter Janney, Mary's Mosaic, third edition, the CIA conspiracy to murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Pinchot Meyer, and their vision for world peace. What happened to Mary's diary, Peter?
What happened was that the diary was confiscated by Jim Angleton on the night of the murder. And that is very clear from what Bradley has said, that they were in Mary's studio on the night of the murder. That's what Bradley testified to at the trial. Of course, 25 years later, he tells a very different story in his memoir. That, you know, they didn't, you know, confront Angleton until the next day, first at the house and then at her studio. There is just a web of deceit surrounding this diary. You know, Bradley and his wife wanted to make the diary into an artist sketchbook that had just a lot of swatches of color in it that Mary was working with, you know, cryptic comments written in the margins about her affair with JFK. That was not the diary, I maintain. The real diary was taken by Angleton on the night of the murder in her studio, and that's when Bradley and Angleton went into their Mary's studio. So, in terms of the actual content of the diary, we don't know. Another author, Leo DeMore, who was working on this story, claimed to have pages from the diary, and I think he did have some information. I knew Mr. DeMore. I developed a relationship with him, and he was very explicit in confiding to me some of the things that were there in terms of what was taking place in their relationship and the support that Mary was giving to Jack throughout this whole period. It was clear that, you know, for JFK, his relationship with Mary Meyer was unlike any other relationship he had had with a woman. Of course, he was a rampant womanizer. He had what I would clinically call a full-bore sexual addiction. But this was indicative, Richard, of someone who had a lot of trouble with intimacy, particularly with women, because of all the problems that he had had with his own mother. And I think Mary came along and finally confronted Jack in such a way that she gave him an opportunity to do something very different with her. And she made it very clear, look, if you're not going to play ball with me here and participate in what we have, I'm just going to walk away because I don't need this. You know, I'm an independent woman. I have my own money. I don't care about who you are. You know who I am, Jack. And I think this really, in a way, helped JFK understand that this could be what I call a relationship of redemption for him. And so we see in the fall of 1963, JFK tells Kenny O'Donnell, his special assistant, he confides to Kenny that you know, after he gets out of the White House, his plan is to divorce Jackie so that he can be with Mary. That is where this relationship is going. And you know, Kenny O'Donnell was not the only source for this. Charlie Bartlett, another journalist who was very close with Jack Kennedy, told me unabashedly in an interview that JFK had come to him and said that he was in love with Mary, and he wanted, you know, Charlie's input on, you know, how, you know, he should handle this relationship, because it was something becoming increasingly near and dear to him.
All right, let's dip into the phone calls here. Let's go west of the Rockies, and we have a Mr. or Ms. Anonymous on the line. Go ahead, caller. All right, we have lost Anonymous. First-time caller line, Ron is in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Good morning. Welcome to Coast, Ron.
Good morning. I just finished your book. This is uncanny that you're on right now. Well written, fascinating. I was curious about Alan Dulles. Who was this guy? Who did he really represent? Was he just an uber psychotic or what?
Well, the Dulles brothers, of course, are very prominent figures on the American scene in the 1950s. Alan's brother, John Foster Dulles, is the Secretary of State under Eisenhower. And, of course, the two of them together are really planning and activating certain kinds of operations throughout the world to overthrow governments and to undergo assassinations if necessary for countries that are not, you know, falling in line with what the United States would like them to do. So these guys are, you know, major players. They were both lawyers. They both worked at this law firm in New York City called Sullivan and Cromwell. And if you're interested in Alan Dulles, there's a new book that's come out in the last year. It is absolutely one of the best books ever written on Cold War history. It's called The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot. I strongly recommend that if you really want to find out who Alan Dulles is, this is the book to get. You won't be able to put it down.
And the Dulles brothers, if I'm not mistaken, were also deeply involved in helping Nazi officials basically spirit their war plunder out of Europe at the close of the war.
Absolutely. That was called Operation Paperclip. And the United States, you know, sequestered a number of Nazis who had a lot of very useful information about Russia and what Russia was doing. And, of course, they wanted a lot of the Nazi scientists who had, you know, backgrounds in rocket science, that kind of thing. And they secretly brought them into this country, gave them a new identities, and, you know, used them for various purposes.
Well, there, to be sure, there were the scientists and Wernher von Braun and so forth, but there was also the war plunder. I understand that they helped them get out and to places like Argentina, and we're talking about gold and well, war plunder.
Yes, there was quite a bit of that. I haven't really gone into that material for quite some time, so I can't speak authoritatively on it. But the real thing to remember is that, you know, the CIA behind the scenes was conducting its own foreign policy, and a lot of the Nazis who were just, you know, criminal beyond belief got really good deals, quote unquote, at the end of World War II in terms of what their lives would eventually become.
Right. It would have been the hangman's noose at Nuremberg. Peter is in Asheville, North Carolina. Peter, good morning. Welcome to Coast. Do we have Peter in Asheville? All right, let's try. Oh, wait a second. I think I've got the wrong set of lines here. It's Thomas in La Jolla, California. Thomas, good morning.
Great interview, Richard and Peter Janey. I look forward to obtaining and reading your book. And I first read about Mary Meyer in Timothy Leary's memoir, Flashback, which he wrote about 30 years ago. And in that memoir, Timothy Leary explained that he coached Mary Meyer in the Harvard protocol of set and setting, you know, concerning psychotropics. And set and setting is a positive mental state and a positive setting creates a great mental experience. And I question the federal government calling these pharmaceutical grade, mescaline, psilocybin, et cetera, as hallucinogens, because under proper protocol, which I'm sure Mary Meyer trained and coached by Timothy Leary, does not produce hallucinations. You know, not on pharmaceutical grade LSD, mescaline.
Microdosing, in other words, microdosing.
Absolutely, and set and setting that protocol. And,
all right, let's get a comment from Peter.
Very good input on the part of the caller. In fact, just in this last week, there have been two articles in the New York Times, one about psilocybin and one about MMDA, that are now studies that are now being used using these drugs for post-traumatic stress disorder. They've been very effective. They've been very effective for cancer patients who are dealing with anxiety. And of course, Timothy Leary knew the curative effects, as did Mary Meyer, of these substances many, many years ago. And of course, they have been shunned by our government because of what took place in the late 60s. And basically, now we're beginning to see a resurgence, as we are with marijuana to one degree or another, in terms of the curative powers, the healing powers that these substances can bring.
All right, wildcard line, Roy is in Summerfield, North Carolina. Good morning, Roy. Welcome to Coast.
Thank you so much, Richard. You're the best Coast host. You have the best guest. Peter, I love Mary's Mosaic. I've read it twice. I'm a President Kennedy fanatic, quite the JFK scholar of the assassination. I consider myself, I'm on a lot of the websites. One thing that bugs me that you are so good about that other guys are not is a lot of the, in books even, they'll have it that Mary Pinchot Meyer was the wife of Cord Meyer when President Kennedy was having an affair with her, which she was long divorced. And after the death of their son, as you point out, they were effectively separated and apart. Okay, that's just prelude. One quick question I'd like to ask you, and then one that might involve some explanation. E. Howard Hunt, this, I can't get any reaction for this on the websites. In the last photo by Frank Cancellare in Dealey Plaza, E. Howard Hunt is walking across Elm Street toward the grassy knoll, to the left of a black lady hustling across Elm, left our perspective. Hands in his pockets, looks like he has a gun or two guns. He's not the third of the three tramps, the old man. I wonder, and you have in your book that E. Howard Hunt, St. John Hunt, says that Cord Meyer was one of the masterminds of the assassination. I believe him. Do you think he was?
Well, first of all, let me just say that your comments are excellent. Mark Lane proved beyond a shadow of doubt that E. Howard Hunt was in Dallas on the day of the assassination. As to whether he was where you just outlined, I don't know. But, you know, Hunt lied and lied. Mark Lane got him on the witness stand in this trial against Liberty Lobby and just demolished Hunt's alibi. And it's very, very clear that he was in Dallas on the day of the assassination.
I would just try to get you to look at the Frank Cancellare photos, and the last one, that is E. Howard Hunt in the middle of Elm Street walking from the post office direction. And the other question I'd love to ask you, because there's so much.
Okay, we just have time for one quick one here, Roy.
Okay, William L. Mitchell.
Yes.
You don't think he was the actual shooter? I believe it was one of the Cubans.
No, Mitchell was not the assassin. That is very, very clear now. I do maintain, however, that he was part of the operation. He was part of the team. his role was to frame Ray Crump, which he successfully did in terms of Crump's arrest. Unfortunately, what the CIA never planned on was Dubby Roundtree, the legendary Washington, D.C. African-American attorney, who, as I said earlier, has just been an angel of mercy in terms of giving us the truth and keeping the Mary Meyer story alive to the point where I have taken it today. This is clearly a government assassination that took place, and the reasons for that are crystal clear now in terms of who Mary was and what she was about to do in terms of challenging the Warren Commission right after it came out. This is not a fly-by-night floozy. If Mary had stood up and identified herself and told the world who she was, she would have been listened to, and it would have been a very, very troubling event for those who wanted to embrace the Warren Commission report.
Thank you for the call, Roy. You know, it's interesting you say, as no coincidence that Mary was assassinated just 3 weeks after the release of the Warren Commission. It's also interesting, sitting here doing a program about conspiracies, that the very term conspiracy theory was actually coined by the CIA as a response to all of the cynicism generated after the Warren report came out. I'm wondering, was your father, was Cord Meyer, was James Jesus Angleton, part of the brain trust that coined that term? We have the CIA memo, the declassified memo now available. This is the providence of the term conspiracy theory. Was your father involved in coining the term?
I don't know the answer to that for sure, but he was certainly part of the group that was doing everything possible to undermine Jim Garrison's investigation of Clay Shaw. And that's why in this appendix number 5 in this new edition, you see this meeting taking place in September of 1967. It's a high level, Klan, at the highest level of the agency in terms of people who are present. And Ray Rocha, who is Jim Angleton's chief lieutenant in the counterintelligence department, is part of the meeting. And my father writes on the memo that Rocha felt, quote, that Garrison would indeed obtain a conviction of Shaw for conspiring to assassinate President Kennedy. I mean, this is what you call prima facie evidence.
I'll say, and it's all
was involved.
All nicely documented in Mary's Mosaic, the third edition. Peter Janney, thanks for hanging out. I really enjoyed this.
Great to be with you, Richard. Great to be with you and your listeners. You're a great interviewer.
Appreciate it. Thank you. For George Nori, George Napolis Alliance, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Sean Latasor, Juan Velasquez, Donna Walker, and here in Toronto, Nathan Smith, Scotty Guest, Julia Matika, and Brittany Sprung. I'm Richard Serrett. Thanks for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. So long for now.